who would be reversed. And I guess you could figure out some way of doing that thing, like, well, it's engraved because you actually chisel out the other parts, and then what's left is, you know, the three-dimensional.
Okay, good. I'm willing to say at this stage that the answer is we have two terms, we don't really know what they mean. And all we know at the end is that they're both us. And what you'll see is that to the extent that people quote this, right, what they'll do is they'll project other terms that they know onto this, and you can decide if that's convincing or not. Like bolate, bolate is a term that the Gemara uses, right? Perhaps, right? So maybe that term gets projected back onto you. Maybe that's what it means. Maybe it doesn't mean. I don't know. It's a fruitful avenue for further investigation. If at some point it matters to you to distinguish between media. So you might go engage in an archaeological investigation to find out what these terms really mean and see if there's a third category that they exclude. Right, it sounds like lufa should mean pesel and atuma should mean tumuna. Right, that's the best we can do. Okay, so then we have this peculiar move from atuma to mata, which has a certain assonance to it. Other than that, doesn't seem to connect very well, and from which we move to Asherah and Evan Maskit and all that. Now, what are all those things? What does the connection to Asherah tell us? Right, tell us about what we're talking about.
Idolatry
content. Right, we're in the desert, right? An Asherah, right? Nobody thinks that it's forbidden to plant a tree. Right, and an Asherah, the Chora, doesn't require any kind of other symbolature other than being a sacred grove. Yes, you did.
Is there any chance that Asherah is actually an actual species of tree that was regularly worshipped, but that might have been actually assumed to be a sort of plant in any event, whether you're going to worship it or not?
And then we have Yaselo Shel Evan means what? In the next line.
What do you mean?
So you can't plant a particular kind of tree, and you can't do what with the Evan?
Well,
Mata goes to Shel Eitz, right? So if we go from Mata to anything made of wood, I guess you could. So we go from Asherah, which is a kind of tree, to anything carved out of wood. Could be Asherah as a species. I don't know of any position that says that, but it's certainly plausible there was a time at which the sacred groves of Artemis or Aphrodite, whatever it was, were related to specific kinds of trees. Certainly possible.
Right, so I just keep open the possibility that even though it seems like the context is a Vodazar, there's a possibility that even if the context is a Vodazar, the Isurim themselves don't have to be Lashem Vodazar. They could, right, it might just be, right?
Okay.
Type of thing.
Okay, I think it's a push, but if it holds up, then I'm willing to go for it.
Let's keep it open.
Okay. Well, the problem is at the end is we have Lo Yaseh Lo Dmut Kol Ela, a Lo Yaseh Lo Dmut Kol Semel.
Asherah historically does seem to have meant for Vodazar.
I'm sure it's a sacred grove, yes.
Yeah.
But maybe there was a species that was a sacred grove, and that right, which required the right, if you didn't want to take that position, maybe it'll be established eventually. I can't disprove it. Okay, so we have this melding of psukim, right, where we go away from Lotetelecha Pesel, we go to Lotetelecha Asherah Kol Eitz, right, we get to, right, to Evan Maskit, to, right, to Elohei Chesed, Elohei Zahav, right, and then to Elohei Masecha, right, so we have here is a Midrash Halakha, which is not interpreting a single pasuk, but interpreting the whole complex of psukim. Right, which means right, it seems to be that it sees these as right, it sees these as all one, as all part of one isur. Okay, so at the end of it, we say lo yaselo demut kol ele, right? Aval asitem aval yaselo demut kol semel. Talmud lomar pen tashchitun vasitem chesel tumanat kol semel. And then we have this move, right? Lo yaselo demut kol semel. Which seems to suggest that semel is right, something that does not kol semel is not something all inclusive. Right, so, right. The term semel excludes behema, chayav, oaf, and all the other things. Right, so that's their interpretation of the psukim and dvarim is that kol semel is not a klal, right, and that which afterwards it then explains the details of. But kol semel refers to something specific, which excludes the behemoth chayav. We don't know what the semel is. Right? Really. Okay. The other thing is, right? It says lo yaselo dumut kol ela, but who mentioned the word dumut before?
Oh,
Right, so, how did you read the line Dmut Kolela, right, since there was no, there's no Dmut mentioned previously?
Yes, sir.
Well, we seem to, I mean, we sort of like had a big discussion about that. And the way I sort of got it here at it in the end was that the fact that the Mechilta doesn't mention the term Dmut beforehand and does mention it there, that it's sort of like a throwaway word for him, that he sort of assumes that we're talking about his Dmut the whole time and probably doesn't think he's making a Kiddush by putting it in here.
So what would a... But Dmut doesn't work so well with Asher, with everything but Ashera, Dmut works reasonably well, right? The Pesel and Tmina, they're all Dmuyot of something. But the problem is, right, the problem is that nobody ever mentioned, so far as we can tell previously, the content of the Dmut. Right? So if it had said, Yochel Yased Dmut Mikol Eile, right, we could say, up till now we've talked about materials, right, and now we're going to move on to talking about content. But it says Yochol Yased Lo Dmut Kol Eile. So what is the thing that you're making a Dmut of, as opposed to you're making a Dmut out of that occurred previously?
Well, I mean, Kol Eile would have to be multiple things, so it can't.
Right. So give me one thing we talked about earlier that we made a Dmut of.
Well, why would this have to do with
Kol Eile? Well, Yochol Yased Lo Dmut Kol Eile. So Kol Eile refers to everything above, right? So tell me what previously we made a dmut, right? There was a dmut of, or two objects we can say kol eile, right? So far,
I don't know.
Yeah.
Is the mechilta so mocked with language? I mean, maybe it's just paralleling Aval Yasela and this kol
eile. And it's just, I don't know. That.
I don't know.
I can't tell you. You know, I don't know enough. But that would be. I would have to hypothesize a manuscript error to do that, I think, than to claim it was just randomly saying Kalela. That's hard for me to say. Can't prove it, but it's hard for me to say that. Yes, you do.
Chronologically, is this the first place we're seeing the word Dmut?
Chronologically?
Yeah.
Then Chumash.
Where which pasuk is it in? Sorry, I was
looking through an ink. It's not in the pasuk. Right? Dmut shows up in Bereishis.
Oh, okay, fine. It's not in the pasuk of the Yisur.
No.
Okay.
I have a problem with this. Maybe I'm missing the previous context. Look it up, and there'll be in the previous paragraph that I didn't talk about. But I don't get the continuity. Okay. Now we have later on again. We have Lo Yaselo Dmut Kol Eilech, right? And it may be that Miriam's right that we have is a manuscript error. Right, and that the line Le'asol de Mekolela got copied from later, right, and really it should say something else. Right, that's that. Right, that I'm willing to accept that this. Right, there's a copyist error that happened there. You just have to make that assumption. Okay, so you might think you couldn't do all those dmuyot. Right, and here we're using the word dmut as the translation of the biblical tavnit. Right, and we don't know whether that means that there too we are assuming that glufa, right? It sounds like we're assuming that anything you can't make a pesel or tmuna out of, you also can't make a, right? You also can't make a tavni out of. That's one possibility, right? And we're just because we're all in the same, right? That's assuming, right? It's assuming that you take yachol yased dmut kol eile as correct. So we're saying everything we've talked about previously was a dmut, right? Now here are additional kinds of miyot that are forbidden. The other possibility is that a pesel and a tmuna are not dmuyot. Right? And we only introduce the term dmut when we start talking about a tavnit. But it's hard to say that because the tavnit is introduced by tmunat, right? Pesel, tmunat, kol, semel. So it's hard to say that. So pashtus, I think, is that we are right now assuming that the words pesel, tmuna, and tavnit are there as describing the categories of things that are asur for everything which it is forbidden to make one of, right? Nobody has said yet the only hint we've seen of distinguishing among different kinds of things is to say that you might have thought they were different, but they're not. Okay, so we move right. So we move from there to Dmut Chama Levana Kochavim Mazalot, right? And that puts us in, right? And that puts us into yet another pasuk, and then we right. So we have the Kochavim Mazalot, and then we go to the Malachim Kruvim and the Ofanim and the Chashmalim. So they. Right, so they go into Asher B'Shamayim. And how do we read the how do you read the next line? Right, how do you get Chamal Vanako Chavim Mazalot? How does I Asher B'Shamayim Echold Mut Chamal Vanako Chavim Mazalot apply when? How do you read the whole section? Let's start with that. How do you read that whole section? Right, what's it saying?
It isn't necessarily as smooth as possible.
Okay, so tell me what the flow is, right? What's the Havamina at each stage? What's the Havamina, what's the Maskana?
So the Havamina is that you can make a Dmus of Kamalavanashkavimatalot. You can't make them either.
Right.
The Havamina being that you can make a dmus of Malachim Kuvim and all those things. Talmudom Marashir B'Shamayim. So Maskana is you can't make a dmus of those things as well. Yashir B'Shamayim. Yachol dmus Chalal Manak Kuvim at the Lod. We saw it as, so this was where it got a little not smooth, but based on what the answer is, we read that as, should Meshav HaShamayim just be referring to Chama Omana Kochavim Mazalot?
Should only be referring to? Yeah.
Because it's less.
Uh-huh. So shouldn't that only... So you want to say, Tepentisai Necha HaShamayim Averita Kochavim, that bans Chama Kochavim Mazalot, then we say, aha, so Asher B'Shamayim, which can't be needed for Levana Kochavim Mazalot, must be for Kruvim. And we're going to say, no, maybe maybe the second pasuk comes to teach me, right, Chama Kochavim Mazalot, and there's nothing that teaches us Kruvim.
Yes.
So we have another pasuk, then Mimal, which teaches us what?
Malachim Kruvim Mazalot.
So we end up with, the problem is we end up with two different psukim. We end up with three psukim that teach us two things. That's the problem.
Well, Mimal just comes after Asher B'Shamayim, so it really is
a different pasuk. It's qualifying B'Shamayim.
Right.
Saying, I read it right, had it only said B'Shamayim, it would have been going back on whatever. But since it's, the pasuk is not B'Shamayim, it's B'Shamayim Mimal, that's why this is talking about the angelic figures and not the constellations.
So what is the pasuk of Pentisoi Necha HaShamayim teaching me?
So that ends up teaching you Chama Levana Kochavim.
So...
Right, and this could have been just... this could have been reiterating that. Right, but the fact that it says Mima'al, and right then I have no source text whatsoever for the angelic figures, but, right, instead of using Shamayim again, you use Shamayim Mima'al.
Aha, so the whole purpose of this is just to tell us that the phrase of Shamayim Mima'al teaches us only Kruvim and not... Okay. Okay, good. That's perfectly reasonable. Let's go with that. Okay, how do you read the last line on the page?
Yitzhara for what?
Yeah, Yitzhara for what? And what's Kol Kach? What are we talking about, right? What are we referring to? Right? Why does it have to throw that line in?
So we have so many psukim that get so specific about different kinds of things that were forbidden to make,
because
it could be
Avodah Zarah. Does it say
Avodah Zarah? Well, that's what the whole Drasha was about. The context of the Pesukim is clearly about
it. The context of at least some of the Pesukim is clearly Avodah Zarah.
Yeah.
Right, so if we assume that this is conflating all the Pesukim in the context of Avodah Zarah, and you might look desperately for this Amatlas Heter. Now, I'm always interested in the psychology of people who are desperately looking for the Torah for a heter for Avodah Zarah. And so the Torah says, no, No, you can't even worship a fish. Right, so what really, what kind of Yetzer Hara are we talking about? Are the people?
Or they want to have like a statue, which the Torah is forbidding, because it could be a Avodah Zarah, or we're not allowed to have this kind of art stuff.
I mean, it is a plausible read to say that the Yetzer Hara is a Avodah Zarah, and the Torah is just being very, very strict if you want a Avodah Zarah. Like, you could read it that way if you wanted to. It's not that silly. I'm not sure it's more silly than saying that the Yetzer Hara under question is a person's like aesthetic creative impulse.
I mean, because... I mean, Tanakh says a lot of times that Hashem is a Kelkanet.
And why shouldn't it be referring to Avodah Zarah? As long as you don't assume that Avodah Zarah will necessarily entail that someone would actually reject the Torah, not just halachically reject the Torah, right? Not just that we halachically consider him kofar b'kol ha'Torah kula, but that, right? If there was a plausible, you know, if there were people who accepted Avodah Zarah while still being practicing Jews ostensibly, right? Then that's a plausible Yetzer fighting.
Okay, so we have to introduce here, start of it, right, is the distinction between Avodah Zarah as the impulse to worship other gods, and Avodah Zarah as the impulse to worship God through, right, through some kind of symbol.
Those two, but also there's a possibility of worshiping other gods in addition to God, right? Meaning.
Right. Okay. Right. Or also opposed to monolatry.
Right.
Yes. Okay.
Well, as long as you accept, right, if you accept that, right, then it's plausible that someone could keep the Torah and think he could do other things. So it has to
okay.
forbid that.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. Well, I was just going to say that I think that's also supposed to be an underlying distinction with EP and OT. That we'll come to see is that it was saying Latasu and OT is that you should also make other sort of mediums through which you're going to worship me, nonetheless.
Okay. Right. I think that ET, well, thought about ET sounds like me, sounds less of what is Zarah focused, right? Right. As in the sense of worshiping other gods and more
right.
about how to worship God. Yeah, so we'll get there in a moment. Yes. Yudidi, what do you want to say?
I was going to say, I mean, it might be a little bit easier to wrap our heads around if we just, right, if we can think about, right, the impulse to create sculptures of things, right, it's something that's sort of ambiguous in its idolatry in the first place. It's like, sort of the chazaka is that most things that are made, right, are made for idolatrous purposes, and that it'll be very tempting for people to make this sort of thing, and, you know, always be saying, well, it's not really for idolatry, or God didn't really say we couldn't make this type of thing. And because of that, right, it's really the idolatrous impulse, so people are, you know, tempted to sort of cover it behind, you know, other things. And because of that, it's all rolled into one mushy blob and is not sort of differentiated. It makes more sense that way, but doesn't necessarily make more sense to us.
Okay, so I think what you're saying, tell me if this is right, is saying that the one way to claim it, right, so I made it look ridiculous in a sense, or tried, by saying what people are really looking to the Torah for Heter for Avodah Zarah. But you could claim, no, people looking for the Torah to Heter to make images. Right? And we know that the desire to make images is really at core of Yetzer Hara. Right? Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah. So the Torah goes out of your way to tell you, no, under no circumstances can you make any kind of image, even if it's not to worship it.
Right. With the assumption that almost all images are, right?
Not almost all images are. All images are ultimately result from an idolatrous impulse, whether they're intended, whether they're consciously intended idolatrous zeal. Right, that would be the worst case scenario for visual art, I guess.
Tell yourself that they're consciously intended.
Yes.
Images are an idolatrous thing, sort of innately.
Or maybe we just think that it's not the production of images, but the existence of images, is always a temptation. Pardon?
You're tempted for something else to exist?
Well, the question is it the production of images, or is it that if an image exists, people will worship it? We're not so much concerned about you, right? It's not that we think that your desire to make it is idolatrous, but we think that as long as there are images around, someone else will come along to worship.
But it seems right from the sentence that the Yetzer Hara in question is that of the person who's looking for the heter, right? That is.
Don't know. It says the Torah goes so far against the Yetzer Hara, right? That it doesn't give.
A person who doesn't have Yetzer Hara is looking for Amal Talat Hetzer.
Maybe.
I think the first one does have the. Does have the
okay, I see why that I see why that's more appealing. I don't think it's I don't think it's necessary, but I think it's much more appealing. Okay, now we move from there to a couple of paragraphs later in the Michilta. Now I say up front, I have no idea whether one feels compelled in any sense to read the Michilta Rabbi Ishmael as a consistent text or not. Right, so you can make up your own mind, or you can read whoever whatever scholars you want. So I don't know how to relate it, but. It seems interesting to me, at least, to ask the question, what is the relationship between the Machloket Rabbi Ishmael Rabbi Natan that shows up in the Michilta in Parsha Yud and the Michilta that we saw four paragraphs earlier. Right, so here we have Machloket Rabbi Ishmael Rabbi Natan. So Rabbi Ishmael sounds like he's saying the exact same thing as we learned from Asher B'Shamayim Imal in the previous paragraph. Right, Lodmut Malachim, Lodmut Ofanim, Lodmut Kruvim, although he has a slightly different order, right? That doesn't matter to me. So the question is he telling me something different than the than the previous paragraph? And if so, what would it be? Right? Now I certainly have two different limudim to tell me that I can't do this. Right, yes, Miriam.
I'm just thinking about, like, in terms of these limudim, like, the Gemara generally says, has principles of not to learn multiple things from one pasuk or not to learn one thing from multiple places. And especially this first Michilta that we did with the ending about Kol Kach Adam HaTzibachari Tamara almost seems like a parish on the Torah and more less technical and more just, sort of just, like, trying to talk about a thematic point, and I was just wondering, should we assume that the Michilta is trying to drive halakha or not, or in one or the other?
It's a good question. The answer is, I don't know. I don't, when the Gemara quotes Midrash Halakha, it's generally quoting things like the Michilta, so if you think the Michilta wasn't halakha, then you have to take a position that the Gemara is using it for a purpose other than that which it was intended. Right, that's what I would say. The Gemara doesn't make up Midrash Halakha, mostly it quotes it.
It becomes halakha once it gets to the Gemara.
Certain Midrash Halakha are taken. I don't know if this first one is quoted in Brachim, but certain Midrashim taken as halakha and certain ones not.
Could be that we decided to Midrash Halakha Midrash Agadah, but the Gemara is perfectly happy to look at this and say, hey, you know what, that's really a Agadah. Right, it deals with the categories you want to use. That's possible. It's not a field that has been intensively studied in a way that convinces me, so I don't know the answer. You will see all these drushas show up in the Gemara, and you'll have to figure out what the Gemara does with them, and why some of them show up and not others, maybe. It may very well be that. I don't have a better answer than that. Could also be, right? We don't know. That's choices you have to make when you get to the Gemara. Okay, now Rabbi Natan has this fascinating position. Right, so how do you understand Rabbi Natan? I thought Rabbi Natan is one of the coolest lines we have so far. No? All right, you're on again. What do you think?
Explicitly saying what you suggested from the previous paragraph, that is. It's an attempt to grasp this God in some kind of physical manner.
Right, so it sounds like Rabbi Natan, right? So it sounds like Rabbi Natan is saying, right, Lo Tasun, he said Lo Tasun Iti should be read as Lo Tasun Oti. Lo Tasun Oti means don't make any image of God. Now, the question is, if that's what this pasuk means, does that mean that Rabbi Natan specifically thinks that Lo Tasun Lecha Kol Pesel doesn't mean that?
I would lean towards an interpretation of the Michilta where it's just, here's a bunch of psukim and different
okay. Passages, so I leave it open to you, right? Whether Rabbi Natan necessarily commits you to reading that. The other question is, if you disagree with Rabbi Natan, what does that mean? Right? Must everybody else have a different drasha to get to this result?
Also the fact that they use. Is that the Sheilta used OT?
Uh-huh.
Which is in the reading just kind of, to me, indicates that
here, there's a lot of nice different Torah going around, and we're just kind of compiling them in some, perhaps some more haphazardly, but not necessarily that everything has to be as orderly and everywhere has to fit precisely like the Gemara sometimes tries to do. He lends himself very well to the OC Drasha, because the way the Ta'amei Mikra fell out, right? L'tasun E.T. by itself, with the Nachtandra, doesn't really mean anything. Right? Lo tasun od, right, has an object.
Good, right, yeah, that's certainly true. It has that. So now, but as it makes the point, which may be the most important point to get out of the Chosa, which is what's missing in the Chosa?
Rigor.
No. Content-wise. That's right, that's the point. Content-wise. What does the Mechilta never forbid? Should we get it from Ezra's question? What does the Gemara, right? The Rabbi Natan, what does the Gemara never forbid? No? The Mechilta explicitly... So far we've seen the Mechilta Rabbi Ishmael, right? We're still the Mechilta Rabbi Ishmael. We have two sections of the Mechilta of the Mechilta Rabbi Ishmael. What dmut does it never mention?
Man.
Oh. Right? That's really interesting, right? Now we saw the Shilta could only get, right? The Shilta could only get it from this drasha of Oti. But it turns out that in the Mechilta Rabbi Ishmael, the drasha of Oti has a different purpose. Right? It doesn't localize Oti to human, right, to the human image. It says Yachol Yaseh Lo Kamin Dmud. We don't know what that Dmud is. Now it might be that later on somebody says, well, what would it mean to make a Dmud of God? Obviously the purpose of this drasha is, right, is to talk about the human image. But it's possible that this drasha originally meant that you simply cannot do any image which is explicitly symbolic of God. And if that is the case, then there is in the Mechilta no limud that teaches you anything about the human figure specifically. Now what's interesting to that is that if you go back to the Mechilta Rabbi Shmuel's list of the tavniyot that are forbidden, so what pasuk does he leave out? Zachar Nekeva. Now why does he leave that out? Well, that was funny. What does he do with the pasuk then? Right. So it could be animals of Karnakeva, or it could be that Dmut Kol Ela meant that we were talking about we assume that Loselachol Petzel Kol Tzmuna was talking about human beings all along. And we don't need a drasha to answer it because the presumption is that a Petzel and Tzmuna is human. Right? Because right, we're trying to hear what dmut was there before all these dmuyot that are usher. And the answer is all along we've been assuming that, right, we've been assuming that we're talking about human dmuyot. And the chiddush of these sukkim is that it goes on to animals. So you can read the Mechilta at either extreme. Right? Either you can read the Mechilta as saying that the one dmut for which there's no issue whatsoever is the human dmut. Right? Or you can read the Mechilta that it's obvious that the human dmut is forbidden. Right? And if you want to make it obvious that the human dmut is, if you want to ask the human dmut, you have two ways of doing it. One is that that's just the presumption. That's the dmut that everyone assumes is us, or you don't even need an explanation of it. And Zachar Nekeva just presumably gets rid of the. Even though I didn't mention it, is just to get rid of the misogynist thing, the misogynist impulse that it's only symbols of men or of women, whichever way you want, that would be forbidden. And the other way is that. Right, lutasun oti is really obvious to people that what would it mean to make an image of God? The only thing it could possibly mean to make an image of God is to make a human image. Right, and that, right?
Could it be that the Mechilta takes them out to be referring to the friend?
Could be.
I think it would work well with the Pesukim because the Pesukim have a kol before the Hemav, before and not before the Zachar Nekeva, so it could be Senel, referring to Zachar Nekeva in the second
quarter. If you can get the word Senel to mean that.
Well, it doesn't mean anything else.
That's true. I can't disprove it. Okay, so at the very end of the Mechilta to Rabbi Ishmael, then, right, it has two drushas on Lo Ta'asu Lachem. Right, one is Ho'il V'natnat Terach Rishut La'asav V'et HaMikdash. Harini Yosef V'atei Knesiot
How did you read Rabbi Kiva's drasha?
Which one? Because he reads it's not about Avodah Zarah at all, right?
How do you read it?
Other people only like their gods when they, right?
How do you get it? What's the drasha?
Well, that's when implicitly, right? You know, it's equivalent of, Lo Tasun Kein L'Hashem Elokeichem. Right, he's just reading it the same.
Right.
Or Lo Tasun Yitzi Keilokei Zahav.
Right, or...
Yeah, something like that. Okay, so now, so you have two drushes at the end, which are introduced by Devar Acher. And so here, you know, the question Miriam asked becomes really powerful, which is, we are generally socialized to make this dark choice between Midrash, stark difference between Midrash Halacha and Midrash Agadah, that Midrash Halacha you have to choose among interpretations, and Midrash Agadah you can be pluralistic. Right, that's usually the way we educate. And that's because the Gemara, right, often puts in the claim, well, what does he do with this pasuk? Right, what does he do with that pasuk? So the existence of a Devar Acher in a Midrash Halacha is somewhat annoying. Right, it doesn't fit well with that. And you have to decide if that really is a presumption of Midrash Halacha, or a presumption of just certain sugyot in the Gemara about Midrash Halacha, or maybe it depends on the kind of pasuk you're dealing with. Right, all those possibilities, right? Just to be aware that when you see a Devar Acher, Devar Acher is the kind of thing that we're used to seeing in Rashi, right, and that we don't like seeing Gemara. But if you start looking for it, you'll see it, that this kind of thing shows up more often in Midrash Halacha than you would like.
We also don't know how Midrash Halacha is put together. It's possible that each individual Tana who writes Midrash Halacha has a specific viewpoint, and then it's sort of brought together. However,
Midrash
Halacha was redacted, it had in mind not to resolve the contradictions, but to just bring out all the
things. Right, we don't know. That's why I'm raising the question, because we don't know. Well, or it could be that really this is a machlokas, that the Midrash Halacha isn't interested in constructing machlokot. It just puts all the sources together. But it's a given that if you wanted to do halakha, of course you have to choose between these. Right? That's possible too. Right? Depends. We don't know what the purpose is. We don't know what the editorial principle is. We don't know any of it. Okay. So the now the first question I have is, when it says is that talking about the kruvim specifically, or is that talking about anything? Which one do you think, Jonathan?
My best guess was the Kruvim.
I think it's talking about the Kruvim. Right? So you might think that because it's permitted to make the Kruvim in the Beit HaMikdash, therefore I should be able to make them somewhere else. And we have to figure out just how we get Lo Tasu Lachem to refer to Kruvim specifically.
Because they already assume that Lo Tasu Lachem only means Kruvim, both
plausible. Okay. Perfectly plausible. And why would I not be allowed to make kruvim anywhere else?
Because they're reserved for the Beit HaMikdash.
No. But why would, we say, I might think that you could make, the fact that it exists in the Beit HaMikdash is not the ground for the Isser. Here the fact that it exists in the Beit HaMikdash is the ground for the Heter. I might think that because it's okay in the Beit HaMikdash, therefore it's okay elsewhere, Talmud Lomar, even though it's okay in the Beit HaMikdash, it's still not okay elsewhere. Right? This is the inverse of the Shiltos, where we assume that because it's in the Beit HaMikdash, that's why it should be elsewhere.
Starting with the drasha by Lo Tasu Lo Zav.
Right.
Right. I mean, if you start there, right, you say the kruvim on butter.
Right.
The kruvim on, right, the force of the first part of this drasha is that the kruvim are, right, they're a chiyuv in the Beit HaMikdash.
Right.
Only in the way that it's described. And anything else, right, opposed to everything else, right, all the other kelim you can have some, right, you can change something, right, these are the ones that are the most limited, the most specific,
yeah.
Right, this follows, right, this is just another limitation, right, it's, right, the kruvim have to be specifically exactly this way.
Right, why?
And not only can they, right,
why?
Now, what?
Why?
So it's not clear whether it, right, why that's the case, right?
Give me a speculation. Should be, right,
I mean, presumably...
Presume because? Because what are kruvim?
They're idols. They're man, images of man.
Ah, you think they're images of man.
Or...
What else could they be?
Or...
They could be strafim. And I think it's more pleasure to say that, of course, kruvim should be also. We ban ofanim. We ban all the celestial beings. Right? What we say?
Assuming they're celestial.
Let me say.
Chazal, they're not.
Ah, they're not chazal. This is chazal.
In some terms of chazal, they're not, right?
So that's why I'm trying to read this without presuppositions, right? It seems to me the easiest way to read this without presuppositions is I would have thought kruvim would be forbidden just like ofanim and things, but look, they're mutter in the Beit HaMikdash. So if they're mutter in the Beit HaMikdash, then I might think I should make a distinction between kruvim and other types of angels generally. Kamash malon lo tasun lachem, no, that the heter to make kruvim in the Beit HaMikdash is read as an exception in the Beit HaMikdash for kruvim. But really, kruvim falls into the same category as everything else.
Kruvim are also the exception. Kruvim are also exception to other kelim. Meaning the first half of the drasha doesn't mean kruvim. You read them together.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, first you start the other side of the other. It's not just the kruvim. I mean, kruvim. It's more than just that. The exception is the Samekha. Right? The kruvim are the exception to all the other kelim. Right. Meaning they have more limited. Right. The first thing you know from this midrash is that kruvim are more limited than anything else.
Right. But I'm assuming. Right. You know, that the reason kruvim are limited, right, is that the whole import of this is, wow, kruvim are really the kind of things that should be forbidden. Right? So A, even the Beit HaMikdash are going to limit it, and B, so you might think that by limiting it to the kind, right, that those limitations are enough, and you can make those kinds of kruvim anywhere, kamash malan, no, you can't make, that kruvim are just carved out as an exception to the general prohibition against images, and we always have to figure out why. Right? Why is it so important to have kruvim in the Beit HaMikdash when anywhere else any kind of kruv whatsoever would be completely forbidden? Right, so later on, you'll write. So people are going to try and claim, well, that's because a kruv is a different kind of angel. Right? I would tend to think that pshat in the mechilta, nah. Right? Kruvim are exactly, the whole point of this is that kruvim are exactly like the other kind of angel, but we make an exception. And we have to figure out why we bother making that exception, and claiming that they're angels from a different realm of heaven doesn't seem to me to be the right way to go. But I can't prove that either. Okay, what does the Devar Acher mean, though? Right, what is the Devar Acher? Right, what's the pshat of the Devar Acher?
We have two alternative readings to it.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was very interesting. What we do for aesthetic pleasure like they do for Avodah Zarah. Or like they do also for aesthetic pleasure. Meaning basically, in one reading, that let's say, give an example that if they have art, like Greek god art, which is not necessarily used for Avodah Zarah, but just kind of has its origins in that, and then we similarly construct artwork in our cities, which has nothing to do with Avodah Zarah, so we're just reinterpreting their Avodah Zarah practices for artistic practices,
mm-hmm.
that would be fine, or just like, of course, they just do it for artistic pleasures and simply.
So I might think we could do it for, right, so two possibilities are either we would think that we could do it for art the way they do it for Avodah Zarah, or we would think we could do it for art the way they do it for art.
Right.
And both of them are forbidden.
Right.
Right. What is forbidden?
The idea
of?
Of art.
Or of kruvim, right? That's why the first question matters a great deal.
Right.
Right? Is this a prohibition that relates, is this position saying that you might think you could make kruvim for art the way other people make kruvim, kamash malan, you can, and whether the other people make kruvim for Avodah Zarah or the other people make kruvim for art, right? That's a historical question, right, among others. There are kruvim on Babylonian, at the entrances to Babylonian temples. Yes, Miriam.
I saw it slightly differently, that it's talking about the intention of making kruvim, that you shouldn't say, these kruvim that we're making today for Mikdash are for art. You shouldn't make it for you.
That's very clever. Contextually, I'm not at all convinced, but it's very clever. So
why
I, because we haven't, I haven't seen any place else, right, where it uses lachem. In, I guess the previous Rashi does sort of use lachem that way, right? He's written about saying, lo tasu lachem, don't make it for yourself. Still not convinced, but it's very clever. I have to think about it. Yasher Kolchech for coming up with it. I have to figure out why I don't think it's true, and then figure out if my reason is compelling or not. Yes, Vijay.
Also, probably, it's okay to bear in mind that there is, right, a lota suni ti drasha brought in the she'ilta that regards, that is regarding things like the menorah and the shulchan.
Mm-hmm.
And that it could be that this lota shulchan would be an addendum for that, it could be an addendum for that. Either as well, or originally an imported, or something like that.
That's right. Now, the other thing mystic in the Mechilta, right, is that there, right, is that there's no mention of doing things like the Minim Mikdash, right. In other words, right, you know, the overall thing is that the, except for the, well, Malachim and Ofanim and Kruvim are all banned, right. We have the drasha of Dmut Shem Shai from Rabbi Ishmael. Right, but it never talks about Shemashim Shomata.
Right, no, I think, but the Eloi Chatabel Zahav in here is, right, is talking about the Kuvim.
Right, and then you want to extend it, so you want to extend this,
right.
The Devar Acher is really the way in which we sneak in the Beit HaMikdash.
Or it could be the Lotas Ulachem is the way that we sneak in the first Devar after the end of the Kuvim section, right?
Yeah. Right, do you want to use even both sections? Both sections are really broad.
So the
core question is whether the context of Lo Tasu Lachem is the previous paragraph, which is the Kruvim, or something else. And then the really fun thing would be to claim, if you think it's only about the Kruvim, does that tell me that these things are mutter for everything else? Right, this is actually a heter. I can't make Kruvim for Noi. Right, but it's only, but if we make the claim, right, which was I was suggesting earlier, that Kruvim are an exception carved out from the Malachim. Right, so we might, right, so it might be that the Kruvim has specific chumras that don't apply to other Dumiyot, and maybe this is actually saying that Noi generally is a heter. But that heter doesn't apply to Kruvim. Okay, right, and then the Mechilta comes out with a really, so we have Mechilta that allows human figures bichlal, right, and allows anything as long as, right, that's intended for art's sake.
Right, or it's not talking about Kruvim.
And it bans everything.
It bans everything.
Yes, both possibilities are there. Yes, Emily. You could, but you know the really fun way would be to read the Mechilta in reverse, saying no, the fact that we need lachem to create this issur for kruvim teaches you it must be mutter everywhere else, and so we won't use those sukkim for that. We can always speculate that it's some pasuk that the Mechilta didn't mention that it would use to aser everything else, right? But it seems to me more parsimonious to say that the Mechilta didn't tell us it's aser, it didn't think so.
Mood of trying to stay away from the Yisra Hara.
Right.
Do all these things, and, you nitpick at the specific.
Well, it depends on how you read that. If you read those as a ban against all images, right, that the image making impulse per se is the Yisra Hara, then true. But if you read that as the desire to make images for religious purposes. And the whole purpose of that is, no, you can never make an image for religious purposes, so then the whole context was religious purposes, and obviously, if it's not intended for explicitly religious purposes, it's fine. Right, so all these readings interconnect, right, the choice you make in one will impact on the other. And then you can decide whether it matters, or after all, it's only a Mechilta, right, so whether you think what the Midrash HaLacham that means, maybe you just care about the Gemara in the end anyway. Right, that's also possible. Although, what I would preview is, many of the Rishonim have seen this, and some of them will possibly read the Gemara in light of this rather than the other way around. We're socialized to read it that way. But some of them may have read it the other way, and so you may see readings of Gemara which seem really outlandish, but then you say, oh, yes, that's a really outlandish reading of the Gemara, but it's a perfectly plausible reading of the Mechilta. Maybe they read the Gemara in light of the Mechilta. Right, that's right, it's part of the reason of doing it this way, right? Is to understand that Rishonim may not have assumed that you start from Gemara. In the same way, they may have felt illegitimate to interpret Gemara in light of Midrash Halacha. Okay, now the Mechilta Rashim Bar Yochai starts off with this fun line: Lo ta'aseh shema tomar eset tura ve'evodota. Okay, right. So here we have Ezra's very nice comment beside here. What kind of havamin is this? Excellent question. I shall adopt it. Okay. what kind of havamin is this? What's the havamin? Yeah.
You could just like Rabbi Natan.
It's not only that I can just make an image, right? I can just make an image of God. Exactly right. That's the Pasha. Now, here they have to understand, where does this take place in Chumash?
Shema.
Right before? No, right after Matan Torah and before the ego.
On the assumption that that's what the ego is supposed to be.
So, right, so one of the ways of reading, reading this, right, is if you read the halakha in the context of the narrative, right, so you will likely read the section immediately after the Asar HaDibrot as saying, right, I just want to be clear, right, I didn't mean that, right, right. So that is, although Lotzeh is actually part of the Dibro, but right, you want, but so you can do it either way. But the underlying thing is that if you think that people read the ego as an attempt to worship God as opposed to vice versa, which is a machlokas Rishonim, right? So then you'll understand why there would need to be a pasuk immediately afterwards which said this. But it'd be really cool if they didn't say it explicitly. So you have to learn the pasuk, right, so that you can understand how the Havamina, right? If they didn't learn this midrash halacha, then that's how all this happened. Because they didn't know this. And this is an ongoing question about whether Midrash Halakha reads the halachic sections of Chumash in isolation, or whether part of the nature of Midrash Halakha is to figure out why these laws are given at this section point in the narrative. Right. So I would tend to think there's a lot of attraction in suggesting that the reason you make this drasha here is because you want there to have been an explicit prohibition of this before the ego. Okay, Rachel, do you want to say something?
I was just saying, I'm not sure if this is relevant, but at least when we were studying in Costa Rica, we were talking, well, it occurred to me that this also brings up the question of Midrash Yotzer, Midrash Hakayam, and sort of, are they starting from the Pasuk and then making a drasha on it? Or is it already a given that, we want to make it 2 points because we already know that the rule is that you would be committing two of Averot, Mishu Lo-Yet and Mishu Lucha.
Yeah.
And so therefore, in other words, do they already know somehow the Halacha beforehand and then they're taking these Pesukim in order to draw a connection? Or are they taking these Pesukim and saying, we don't know what to make of it?
That's a good question. I don't know if here you can come with any evidence one way or the other. I don't know.
I'm not.
Mary, did you want to say something before?
I guess the first thing that I was thinking to say was that the easiest way to look at this was this is the first, like in terms of context, was that this is the first time a Avodah Zarah is prohibited. So, yeah, the Havamina one is that you can worship a Avodah Zarah because you never know otherwise. But I just realized that if we're talking about Lotasa, Lo Yielcha comes first. So Lo Yielcha could have meant don't worship other gods in heaven, or, think that there's some other gods, and then Lotasa is, so, okay, you can't worship other gods in heaven, then I would have thought I could make a tour on earth and worship it.
Okay, right, it's fairly reasonable. It's interesting they make the drash from Lotasa, that you can't make it and worship it, right, as opposed, right?
Right, well, because not to worship comes soon enough after.
Could be, but the question is, why does it say Shema Tomar Eset Tura Ve'Vodota? Why doesn't it just say Shema Tomar Eset Tura?
So presumably he reads those two parts of the
public. Connected. So is there any prohibition here against making a Tura if you're not going to worship it?
I don't know, could be.
Could be, but there's nothing mentioned. Right? So nothing mentioned at all of anything, right? Because they had the option, they could have said, Yachol Yomar Eset Turah Velo Avodata, Talmud Lomar Lo Taaseh, but it doesn't. It says, Yachol Eset Turah Velovodata, Talmud Lomar Lo Taaseh, which is really interesting. Right? It didn't take the opportunity to ban Asiya without worship.
But it also doesn't specifically say that that's not the case.
That's true. Doesn't it? Just misses the opportunity. I'm going to assume, right, I think that unless somebody tells you something's usher, it's mutter. You know, that's my ideological premise in Midrash Halakha. But I can't demonstrate that either. Yes, Jonathan.
At least one of the reads suggested in the earlier part of this Midrash is, right, creating an image to serve God. I mean, you have this very problematic, you know, part, a little, what was it, like 10 lines before?
Right.
So, it's not entirely clear what that means. At least one of the Paul's over, at least, you know, like, Rav Zvi Hoffman understands this line as meaning, right, don't create something to serve God. Right, in the Kuzari, when he quotes, in the Kuzari Egel way.
Right.
Right, so if you have that 10 lines before, it's unlikely that this line is going to mean that, it is going to mean the same thing.
Could be, although the question is, you have a Devar Acher there.
It could be, but it's, you know.
Could be, okay, it's also a fair question. So what is it? What does it mean then?
I don't know. Did you have one suggestion?
Oh, did you just put an Ella?
That's a.
But he went in there and taking out two.
Right, or it's only usher. Right, it's only usher when you say.
Or it could be that you can't make images of gods, and now it's telling us you can't even make images that are not explicitly divine images to worship God. Right. The first thing is you can't even make an image that's explicitly an image of the divinity. And the second is I might think I can make some other kind of image and worship it so long as I don't claim it's an image of God. And the answer is no. Right? I don't know that you can demonstrate. But I don't think there's any evidence in the Mechotzer of Shem Bar Yochai that there's any prohibition of anything which isn't explicitly worship related.
There's another suggestion in that same an enigmatic line, which is that's exactly how to read it. I mean, some people read this as saying you can't make it an idol. Other people read it as you can't make an idol, right? Not, you know, an image, not as idolatry, but not as
or for any other purpose at all.
Right, you read it.
Right, I can see how to read that. But it's Eloa, right? So it's hard to claim that Eloa is all images. Yeah, but it's only an image of an Eloa.
Right, and then there's multiple yourselves of this. That line.
Which line would make a difference? Which Gersa would make a difference?
I mean, some of the Gersa just make it explicitly that you're making it, that you're making it not as an Avodah Zarah, right, and still
Asir. Yeah, that I'm okay with. So making it not as an Avodah Zarah, what do you mean by not making it not as an Avodah Zarah?
Not for worship.
Not for worship, which is not the same as not making it as an image of God. Because you can make images of God and not worship them.
Right.
Right? There are three kinds of things. There are images, actually four kinds of things. There are images to worship, you know, not images of God. There are images to worship which are images of God. And there are images of God that are not to worship. And images that are not of God and not to worship. Right? So, you have to figure out which of these four things is forbidden, right? It's forbidden according to whom, right? You know, let's say figure out what counts as image of God, and the whole question, like, you know, is it us or to watch Thor or something like that? Right, or is that
the illustrated Genesis? Had lots of images of God that aren't to worship.
Yeah, right. I say my book with the God and the architect and the heart head. Right, which I don't think if the purpose of that book was for people to bow down in front of the pages. Should I bring it in, please? Don't.
You bring in the dancing stuff to you.
Right, I have to. Having once been in a group, unfortunately, which in a slightly over-alcoholed group, so the members of the group ended up bowing down to a lava lamp, so I have to caution people about these things. Apparently, when you've had that much alcohol, I would know I was drinking Coke. but since then, I'm much more cautious about presuming that people will or will not bow down to things. All right. Okay. Last thing, right, we have Kol Tmunah, right, which, so we have this whole, right, you have this whole series of things that are banned, Shamayim, Malachi Asharis, etc. We end up saying, right, it says, Kol Tmunah, Lo Dmut Vutan, Shelo Bidmut Bivoa Shelahen, Shelo Bidmut Chayot Ra'ot, Shelo Bidmut Chayot Shomala. So that's an interesting list. To get out of the word coal. Right, you know, this is the stuff that's been left out. All right, so we got, first of all, what's the demus bivoa? All right, the bivoa is a shadow. Right, so I guess you can't make silhouettes. So I'm not sure. Right, so new prohibition, and why, you know, and the equation of chayot ra'ot and chayot shalmala is rather peculiar as well. All right.
I'm not sure that it means chayot ra'ot here means wild animals, what it normally means.
I don't know.
Right, I mean, just because of the parallel, it might mean some sort of demonic something.
Could also mean that. I don't know.
Right.
Could be. You know, they're evil twins. Could be. I don't know. The Mechilta does not seem to have any of the Beis Hamikdash oriented prohibitions. Right. The entirety. It does have the Tzura Adam specifically, right? As the right Tavnit Zacharne Kiva Ben Tzura Adam, but it doesn't have any mention of the right of the Beit Hamikdash, of the Hamikdash phenomenon. So if we were to tie together the three primary texts we've done, so you have the Shiltot, which doesn't have anything to do, doesn't mention Avodah Zarah, but does specifically ban human beings. Right, you have the Mechilta Rabbi Ishmael, which doesn't mention human beings at all, and you have the Mechilta Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, which doesn't mention the Beit HaMikdash at all. Right, so that, right, of all those facts, right, so of the, we wanted to take those as the three, right, the three primary axes, right, you have Avodah Zarah, Beit HaMikdash, and human beings, right, so they all have different approaches on this issue. Okay. So that brings us to the sugya. But rather than going through the sugya per se, I don't want to go very long today. Let's make a couple of quick points about focusing specifically on the Rashi. So the first Rashi, the purpose of the first Rashi in the sugya, right, was to point out to you the right, that the if you what happens to the sugya if you take out the sum. Okay, right? So that's why I did this typeface for you also, right? That we really, if you take out the sum, what you have is a Mishnah which says, Okay. Now, one of the major purposes of the Stam and the Gemara is to write the context in which the Amoraic comments appear. Right, and it's important to realize how your understanding of a statement can be altered by your understanding of what question is coming to answer. Right, because if I didn't have the Stam, I would look and say, right, what is Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Yosef explaining? Right, he's explaining why it is that Reimer takes this position, the Chachamim don't, and the answer, right? And the answer is because look, in Reimer's place, they worship once a year, and so really, right? The Pashup Shad in Rabbi Yitzchak's statement is he's just explaining why Reimer said this was Usher because he had this because in his time, in his place, it was Usher, right? The simplest way of framing it is that what Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Yosef is doing is claiming that there is no real machlokas between Reimer and the Chachamim. Right, it's just that they make their statements in different places. Right, that's the pashut pshat in Bimkomo Shalei Meir Hayovdin Asa Pam Achat Bashana. But the Stam comes along and says, no, that's not what pshat in the sugya is. Really, pshat in the sugya is that everyone knew that it was worship, or at least the Stam apparently says this. We'll see if the Ramban qualifies it dramatically. But the Stam apparently says that pshat in the sugya is that everybody knew that it was worship once a year, and the Meir was Chayesh L'miyusa, and the Chachamim were not Chayesh L'miyusa. Right, so now Rashi's question is, how does the Gemara know that? And the answer, Rashi says, is because Chachamim say Eino Aser Ella, as opposed to saying Eino Ne'evad Ella. Right, which is a fine answer, except that it assumes that Yitzchak Bar Yosef is arguing that the Chachamim knew about Rav Meir's position and rejected it, but Rav Yitzchak Bar Yosef could just be saying Rav Meir knew something the Chachamim didn't, or Rav Meir said something about his place the Chachamim didn't. Right, nothing in Rashi's proof, nothing. If the question was, did Rav Meir mean, right? Did Rav Meir mean to oster it everywhere? Or did Rav Meir mean to oster it only in his place? And when the Chacham disagree, were they just referring to a different location? Right. So Eino Aser, right? Eino Aser, right? Just means that right? They weren't responding to Rav Meir. Okay. But nonetheless, right? And we'll see that later on, some Rishonim, right, the problem, which I think some of you got in Chavruta, the problem with Rashi's interpretation and the Stam's interpretation is, if Rav Meir's position is really built on Chayesh L'miyuta, then what does it matter whether it's Mekomo Shalei Meir HaYovdin Osa or anywhere else? As long as there's a place in the world, Rav Meir should be Chayesh L'miyuta. Right, the claim that it's Mekomo Shalei Meir seems to indicate that Rav Meir was making a halacha about his place. The cholik now they're interpreting. I think that they're a comment on Rav Meir. Rav Yitzchak Bar Yosef says in Kolosh Rav Meir of Dinasa Pamachas Bashana. The Stam's asking the question, right? As it puts in, right? If that's the case, so what? Right? So why? So this is Nevad. So what's the Rabbanan's position? So the answer is it's machlokas about whether Chayesh L'miyuta. Right. The two comments of the Stam go together. Right, I think the two comments of the Stam go together. Right. So they recognize, right, is that they write the question. And then having written the question, they tell you, right, they explain the answer in a way that answers it. Right, that's right. So what I want you to get out of this is that reading sugyot in order doesn't tell you what really happened. Right, because what really happened is Rav Yitzchak Bar Yosef is there, and then they write, the Stam is written around Rav Yitzchak Bar Yosef, and you have to write both the question and the answer. Now this is not telling you that that's not pshat, right, in the sense, maybe they had a masoret. But literally, what happened is they wrote the question and the answer. Okay, the second thing Rashi does is he says, right, Kisham, right, but when we have the next statement, the next Amoraic statement, the Gemara is Amoraic.
Yeah. Is it possible to read the question as, to read
Rav
Meir's answer as responding to the question independently?
Which question independently? We always distinguish between the.
You can read Rabbi
Yitzchak
as answering that question.
Yes, the Stam does. And I'm not saying he's wrong.
No,
how does Rabbi Yitzchak's statement, which is about Rabbi Meir? Then it should say Rabbi Mekomosh Rav Meir Bilvad, right? It's not, right, you know, could be. Right? I think it's easier to, right, if you look at it this way, to see that the question, the easy example is as follows, right? So often, right, often a Gemara goes like this, my Tama, Omar Rabbi so-and-so. Right? So you could write it just as easily, Omar Rabbi so-and-so, my Tama. It doesn't make any difference, right, whether you put the my Tama into the statement by the Amora, or you make the Maitama in the Stam, because it's obvious that what he's doing is giving a reason. Right? So usually you can't tell the difference. Here, there seems to be a gap, because we don't know what, right, because Rizko Bar Yosef seems to be answering, right, a question which is, the question he seems to be answering is, why does Rabbi Meir know this and the Chachamim not? And the Stam says, no, that's not what he's answering. He's really answering the question about the Rabbanan, which is a push, and in order to do that, we have to then explain it further. So it's not so convincing. But whether it matters that it's convincing or not is a different question, and just because it's not convincing in the abstract doesn't mean there isn't a Masoret. And I spend a lot of my time in my academic work just trying to demonstrate that much of what the Gemara does is Masoret, and so there's no, right, so you, the fact that it's not obvious doesn't prove anything. That's just what the Masoret was. But here I'm not so sure. Okay, second, right, so then the Gemara goes on and says, Amar Avidomar Shmuel, Be'andarti Shel Melachim Shaninu. So the problem we have is we don't know what Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel is talking about. Nothing in the Gemara tells us Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel is talking about. Right, so, and, right, Pashtus, he could be relating to Rav Meir, he could be relating to the Chachamim, and he could be relating to Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, and he could be explaining either the, right, why they asser certain things, or why they only asser certain things. We don't know which of these it is. So Rashi goes out of his way and he tells you, first of all, he tells you what Andarti is, but he goes along and he says, the Hasam Kaasar Rimeir, the Agav Chavivusa Polchile, right? So he says that Rimeir's statement that right, that bans Kol HaTzlamim, right, that Isur only applies to Andarti Shel Melachim, because Andarti Shel Melachim are, right, Agav Chavivusa Polchile. Now that's a difficult pshat to understand, because Rimeir says to Nevalim Pam Achas Bashana. So Agav Chavivusa, they get, right, they get worshipped once a year? Right, that's a strange line. I don't know why Rashi has to throw in the line Agav Chavivusa, although we'll find out later.
Even they get worshipped once a year.
Even they?
Yeah.
No, Rimeir only asters them.
What?
Rimeir only asters them, right? All other, right? He says Rimeir, right, when Rimeir says Kol Asplam Asurim, he means Andarti Shel Melachim.
Right, you could say like this, right? Okay, so picture idols of Jupiter, right? That's not even a question, right? But so this, right? So the Andarti Shel Melech, right? But like other things that are ambiguous and not gods or those things, right? Those are mutter, because even those, right, are worshipped.
Okay, great, but nonetheless, the point of the statement is to have Rabbi Meir not ban slamim that are not of kings.
Yeah.
Right, and maybe idols, obviously, but lions are fine.
Right.
Okay, yes, yeah.
I was thinking that they worship once a year. It makes sense if it was their birthday or death day, that's when you would worship the king. It's not strange. If you have a nice king, you'd worship him once a year.
We're absolutely right. The only question is why Rashi has to word throw in the line to Agav Chavivusa. Right, that doesn't seem... Right, that's a strange line. We'll find out where Rashi gets it in the next sugya. But it's a strange line. It's a strange line. Where is this sugya?
Well, the question isn't just
next sugya.
Why people will be worshiping kings.
Go ahead and know why does Rashi need to say that, right? You know, why doesn't he just say that right, statues of kings get worshipped once a year on his birthday?
Maybe he thinks we would be curious.
Does he know?
What?
How does he know that that's why they get... Why does
maybe
he just...
Maybe he knows from the other sugya.
Uh-huh. Well, we'll see if he knows from the other sugya.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll have to see. It's a strange line for Rashi to throw in, I think. But the key point is that Rashi is telling you that this line is referring specifically to Rabbi Meir. And then, naturally, Rashi, right, the next line, right, Amar Rav Rabba Machloket, sorry, the next line is, right, Amar Rav Barchanan, V'omdin al Petach, V'omdin al Petach, Medina Shaninu, right, so Rashi, that obviously has to, right, Rashi says it has to relate to Rabbi Meir. Also, So Rashi ends up telling us that the context of the opening sugya is just, right, is a constant narrowing of Kol HaTzlamim. So the first thing is Kol HaTzlamim, right, so Rav Yitzchak Bar Yosef, Rabbi Yochanan, actually expands it, right, and says, Rabbi Meir banned it everywhere because in his place they did that. Meaning that the mayor banned these idols even in places where they weren't worshipped. Right, that's what it sounds like. Right, in his place they worshipped it once a year, and he's chayish lamiyuta. So it sounds like he bans it even in places, right? He bans it even in places where they aren't worshipped. Now, why should that be? Right, so we can get out of it by claiming that he's not banning them even. Right, he's banning them if you find them anywhere. Because he knows there's one place in the world where they're worshipped. Right? And that will move Kol HaTzlamim into the range, into the talking about finding lost idols as opposed to making idols. So yeah, Rashi says that according to Meir, all the slanim are forbidden, because in his place they worship them, right? They worship them once a year. So what does that mean? So, but other places they don't worship them once a year.
Doesn't mean they don't exist.
Right, but they don't worship them. What's the problem? The reason they're forbidden is because they worship once a year, and in his place. So, right, so Meir lives in Chicago, and in Chicago they bow down to the idol of Richard Daley once a year, right? But in New York, nobody ever bows down to the idol of Richard Daley. So why should the knowledge that they bow down in Meir's place ban it in New York, right? The only reasonable explanation is to say that we're not talking about the idol of Richard Daley that's in Central Park in New York, which everyone knows, no one bows down to it. We're talking about a little statuette of Richard Daley that you find on the street anywhere in the world. And you're worried, right? And so you say, Rav Meir's Chayesh Lamuta means that he is concerned that this one came from Chicago. Because he knows there's one place in the world where idols of Richard Daley are worshipped.
So why can't it not be lost and it just end up in Chicago or someone?
But why? I'm in New York right now. And Rav Meir tells me I can't, Rav Meir tells me I'm not, right, that the idol of Richard Daley is forbidden because it's worshipped in Chicago.
Yeah.
But I'm in New York. In Chicago, why should I? But I know this one wasn't worshipped. It's in New York.
Well, is the question really about whether this particular idol was worshipped in the past? If you have a brand new idol that you thought being made in Chicago, just because it's Chicago doesn't mean.
Good, exactly right. That's why this will all move this into the realm that Rameer must be talking about finding random idols. Otherwise, Chayesh Lemuta makes no sense. What minority is he concerned about? It didn't happen. Why would worshipable? Anything is worshipable.
Worship in general culture,
right? So the mayor just bans anything which is worshipped anywhere because we're chayesh lemuta, because that makes it worshipable?
Or maybe because someone could worship it in the future.
Okay, you want? Let's hold that for now. I don't think it'll hold up, but hold it for now, and we'll see as we go on to the whether that holds up or not. Yes, you do.
No, I was going to say that the Muta could just be the random Chicagoan who shows up in New York.
He's closer to the random Chicagoan who shows up in New York, and therefore...
And therefore, Chayesh Lemuta, even New York thereafter, because...
There might be a Chicagoan somewhere who will bow down to it.
Exactly.
All right, that's not bad. All right, that will go together with what Miriam suggested.
What if there's a place where they have idols of the king, but they don't worship it ever?
Yes, yeah, so that's the problem with Meir's position, right? So Yedidia says we're afraid you still can't have them because people who come from places where they worship idols of the king will worship it. So it's a
different king. Yeah, that's right.
So I figure out maybe people who worship kings are indiscriminate. You know, I'm not an expert on the psychology of idolaters. Maybe there's some people who just go and genuflect at the altars of the local king once a year because it's politically wise.
So
that's the question. Does it have the history of being worshipped? Does it have to have people now who worship it? Does it have to be potentially worshipable? Right, that's right. All three options show up here. I think Chayesh Lemuta will tend us towards one direction, but we'll see that in the Gemara next. All right, then the next sukkah end up limiting Rav Meir to claim that, right, that Rav Meir is only talking about Andarti Shamalachim, he's only talking about Omdin al Petach Medina. The question is, are these assuming Rav Yitzchak Rav Yosef's Okimta, meaning that in Rav Meir's place the custom was that they worshipped the statues of the kings that stood at the entrance to the city once a year? Right? Or are they alternatives, right? Saying that Rav Meir says that the idols of, when Rav Meir says that all images are worshipped once a year, what he really meant was all images of kings that stand on the outskirts of cities. Are worshipped once a year. Now, in order to make that happen, because the word, right, to get the word Kol HaTzlamim to mean only images of kings that are standing at the statues of the entrances to cities, right? You have to make the word Tzelem mean something very narrow, right? Because how can you get Kol HaTzlamim to mean only one of the, right? Mean only that. And that's right. So one of the issues that we have to be addressing is, right, does the word tselem have a very specific meaning? Does it mean, for example, a statue of an entire human being?
Why can't it be more based because of context? Like, I don't know what the context of the Mishnah is, but maybe Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Hana are saying that tselem could mean anything, but the Mishnah, when the Mishnah says kol ha-tselemim, it has to be referring to something because that's
the only thing that would be holistically possible
because of other context. And it doesn't need to use a specific word because that's obvious to anyone who knows.
Well, the word kol is problematic. Right? Anytime...
falls
into
this category.
The category of statues of kings standing on the entrances to cities.
Like, assuming that we're talking about statues of kings that stand on the entrance to cities, what we're in that framework, and then kol ha-tselemim up through it.
That's right, but that's a big, right, it's a peculiar language. If you know in advance you're talking about a subcategory of a subcategory of statues, not statues of people, but statues of kings, not statues of kings, but statues of kings that stand at the entrance to cities, right, and the way we express that is kol ha-tselemim.
Well, because it's clearly different than Chachamim and the Mishnah and Gamliel, so I mean, it's kol is everything in that category.
Okay. So now another question, right, is, do the Chacham and Rashim and Gamliel agree with this Okimta and say, right, and the Chacham believe that even a statue which has a makel, if it's not a statue of a king at the entrance to a city, is mutter. Right, and when Rashi says, Bahanu ka'asar v'meir, right, does that mean that the Chacham are cholik and say that, right, and say that, right, sorry, the Chacham agree in principle that the only machloket, that's what Miriam's arguing, is that the only machloket is about statues of kings at the entrance to cities, and the Chachamim are saying even statues at the entrance to cities are only usur when you do that. Okay, and that's the more fun way of reading this machloket, the opening stam rejects, is to say that, you know what, there are statues that are worshipped once a year, and nonetheless, they're not usur in the same way. Right, that would be the radical way of reading it. You know what? It gets worshipped once a year, but you know what? That's not really what it's about. It's a statue. People kind of bow down to it once a year. Nunu. Right? That would be the wildest. Right? That would be the wildest way of reading it. See if you can write. Those are mayor. We agree. Now that Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Yosef says no, that can't be. It must be a machlokas and metzias because nobody would think that a statue bow down to once a year is not really a god. But culturally, I don't know if it's not impossible to believe that statues that are worshipped once a year, everyone knows they're not really idols. Because they're really idols, we'd worship them all the time. I don't know, that you'd have to know more about Roman culture.
Or maybe the Okimta is about the Messiah. Right?
Meaning, yeah.
They, right? But that's the same thing that you write, what, really all Tselemim are worshipped one time a year? No, he's talking about, those are the ones that are worshipped.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think that's true that that's what they're doing. They're saying, right? Not every, right, we all know that not every statue is worshipped once a year. Right? And that's why, right, that's why Rashi has to come up with an Okimta from Mikoma Shalomir, which is different than Andarchi Shamalakim and Omid Al Tanava Yir, so he comes with Algiv Chavivuse. Right, something like that. Okay, last thing I want to say. You should be all aware of the word teku. This is a word which I learned originally from Louis Jacobs. There's a book called Teku, which is really fun. So when I was in yeshiva in elementary school, they taught us that Teku was a failure. Teku meant that, look, we didn't know the answer to this question. That's probably how most of you were taught, right? Tishbi, Yataris, Kushiyot, Vibaya, in the end. So what Louis Jacobs argued, and I think utterly compellingly, is that often Teku is not a failure, but a success. Think of you having a competition. And the competition is, who can ask the question which pushes our knowledge to the limit that you can't answer it on the basis of precedent. And the winner is the person, right? So teku is a triumph because teku is a success because it means we understand exactly how far the formulation goes. Right? So here it's not, darn it, we were looking for a formulation which would tell us exactly what the Chachamim meant, but actually what we're looking for is we had Rashi Ben Gamliel comes out of the position anything in your hands. We want to know: does he really mean? Is he making a gzera lo plug? Right? He's saying that we're not going to try and interpret their symbol. So anything which is forbidden, anything which holds in the hand is forbidden. Or is he making a sociological judgment, which is saying that these are statues which have things in their hands are more likely to be worshipped. So somebody comes along and says, well, let's test that. Right? The easiest way to test whether this is a low plug or a substantive claim is if he's holding something which is obviously disgusting. Right? And the answer is, right, and there we are, right? So somebody says, good, Teku, we don't know the answer to that one. Right? You found a good test case, which tests our formulation, and we don't have an answer. And the competition in yeshiva would be to be the person who came up with the question that could not be answered.
How you view Teku, is that at all relevant? I mean, it seems like you mean it the same way. It seems like it has the same function. And the only difference is your state of mind in terms of happiness.
Yeah, that is, it matters, you know, what you might think the halakhic approach is. But I'll give you,
How is that?
Because it might be that we'll just say, you know what? So the Teku just tells us that this is all right. You wouldn't necessarily want to try and find dispositive evidence from somewhere else.
Also, why do you say utterly compellingly? Kind of a perspective.
I mean, you might want to find dispositive.
Pardon?
Well,
you might want to find dispositive evidence just for fun.
Yeah, that makes me get better.
Push the case further. Okay.
What's dispositive evidence?
It's positive evidence that totally solves the issue.
But the other case, you might say if they couldn't find the evidence, then you can't find it either. I mean,
okay, so I'll give you one more nafkamina, which is the third way of understanding Teku, which is that Teku is an attack. In some cases, I think, which is that the question that leads to Teku is an attack, because if I can show you that your formulation doesn't help me answer any questions that are important, it's not that I don't know the answer to it, it's that your formulation fails. So the way I understand the Teku that most of us are introduced to, which is Rabbi Yirmiyah in the beginning of Elul Matzios, right, where somebody comes with a formulation and says, in order for an object to be considered lost, you have to find a kav in four amos. And at the end, right, Rabbi Yirmiyah asks a series of questions. He says, what about two kav in eight amos, half a kav in two amos, a kav of shumshmin, a kav of rimonim? At the end of which, it turns out that the rule, kav in del amos, is useful only if you find exactly a kav of wheat in exactly four amos of space. But any other proportion, we don't know. Right? Any amount less than a kav, any amount less than four amos, any amount more than a kav, any amount more than four amos, we don't know, because his formulation is what about two kavs and eight amos, that works just as well for 1.1 kavs and 500 amos. Because if you take the position the Gemara says that a kav is the boundary as to what people bother picking up, and it's not a ratio. Right? That's the basis of his assertion. If it's a ratio, then of course two kav and eight amos is the same thing. But Rabbi Yirmiyah says the ratio doesn't work, because psychologically one kav is different than two kavs. So Rabbi Yirmiyah actually does. I think the Teku there is Rabbi Yirmiyah saying, I can ask you so many questions that you can't answer based on your formulation. All right? And those questions are so immediate that your formulation fails because it doesn't tell me anything. So, how we treat the halacha is an interesting question. Right? Does it make us more or less likely to paskin like that okimta or not? And that's a much broader question.
If we say that you know, I guess in this case, what Rabbi Shimon is saying is not as good as we would like to, but that doesn't have a halacha complication, then.
Well, I don't think this is an attack. Right? I think this one is fine. Right? So I think this is a victory. But I'm pointing out that if you see the goal as asking a Teku question, then you can recognize that asking a question which can't be answered, right, is not a failure in terms of we didn't come up with the answer, but it's the question can't. We can view the asking of the question as a success, as opposed to the not answering it as a failure. I think that opens up that notion. I think it opens up the notion of what the goal of conversation and shiur is. Right? That sometimes you ask a question and you stump the rabbi. Right? He couldn't answer that, and that's a failure. Right? It's a failure on his part. He couldn't answer your question. And sometimes it's success on both your parts. You understand this well enough that now there's no precedent. And you hit the point where there's no precedent. Right? Sometimes the goal of shir, sometimes should be to get the conversation to the point where you recognize that there isn't precedent.
Like it's interesting. I don't see why it's... It seems like that's talking about a different mindset on behalf of the people involved, but it doesn't have any other than mindset.
Okay, we can talk about that. I think mindset itself matters. Right, that's how I would start. Let's leave it at that for now. I think mindset itself matters. And you know, the metaphor is that, you know, is that. So in the Gemara, when you hit that point, you say teku. But as a posik, you don't have that option. As a posik, when you get to the point where it's teku, what that means is you have discretion. Right, and so that right. So I want to use that as a model for some of the things we do here. Right, part of the purpose that we're trying to accomplish here is to ask the question, is to read the text not to know what the text says, but to read the text in a way that we know what the limits of the text are, right? Which then leaves us in a space where we have discretion. And so I think that, right, one model of reading text, which is the model I like, is to keep reading the text until you can say teku. Right, and that's where creativity starts, as opposed to that's where the conversation ends, because we fail, we don't meet the limits of our knowledge. All right, that's the end of shir.
Could it be that this is explained why the Amoraim seem to have trouble? Since the Tanaim were more aware of Christianity than the Amoraim were, since they lived in a place where it existed,
yeah.
Could it be even just for me being exactly the same?
So you know, there is a position, the Boyarin and all those groups now, which thinks that Christianity is a major concern in the time of the Tanaim. Right. I find no evidence that the Gemara is seriously halakhically responsive.
The Gemara or
Mishnah? Either. Right. I know that
the Gemara, they lived in Babel. It wasn't Christianity that they were so aware of.
Well, the whole Boyarin reads everything about Christianity.
How they've known about it in Babel so much?
Well, yeah, it's a problem. It's a problem. But they knew Eretz Yisrael, right? So the Gemara has lots of Eretz Yisrael influence. I would be hard pressed. I don't know anywhere in the Gemara where the standard of Avodah Zarah is Christian.
Right.
And many of the saints don't exist yet.
Right. I know. I don't know. It's just something. In
right. I understand the theory. If you could demonstrate it, I'd be fine with it.
Right.
My instinct is that Christianity is much less important historically in the time of Chazal than most scholars think nowadays.
Well, one way to demonstrate it is to see if there are certain things that are supposedly presented holding a stick or a bird or a globe.
Yeah, so you should read, there's a book which goes through all of these. But we know there's a Gemara, for example, in Sanhedrin, which presents Alexander the Great as holding a globe. So at least the Gemara seems to think that it's Alexander the Great. And I don't know of any statues of Jesus that hold globes.
No, it might not be him. It could be other people. Maybe.
Saints?
I don't know. Because that would make more sense than Abdul Bamachad B'Shana.
I don't even know if Christian iconography starts that early. I think it'd be interesting to know.
I don't know.
As the investigator, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm just trying to explain Kol Tzvamim as something that is reasonable. I don't know.
Okay, I understand that, but I don't think it's true historically, but you can research it and see if you...
No, I got the amount, and also I think if you check.
Ah, okay, and we gave you the waiver form, right?
Yes, I will give it. Put it in this pouch. Here you go.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. We're going out.
Train. Okay, now there's the high school students are the ones who show real material numbers over here. I have to get home. The rest of us get to stay in this bucolic paradise. All right, good day. Pleasure.
Yeah. So the five has been good.
Pardon?
The five feeling
good. Glad it's up.
Yeah, that's pretty much the same. There's nothing wrong with your bike, by the way. I don't know if there ever was, but if there was, I fixed it, I believe. It was hard to move the rear shifter, but I think it's otherwise okay. And Leah, your bike is fine.
What?
Your bike is fine.
You fixed it?
I did.
How?
Please stop.
How?
I forget. Reparo, that's the spell.
Reparo?
Yeah.
How is
that? I don't know what it is. Isn't that the right spell? Well, hopefully the repair person tomorrow will teach you how to fix it in the long run. But I think holding it upside down and moving the gear manually gave me just enough slack to put it on. Or at any rate, I pushed it around for a little bit, and there it is. Abba, despite the numerous nasty things said about him by his daughter,
he wrecked my chain instead of fixing it. He wrecked her chain.
I did not wreck it. It was off. I just moved it off differently.
More, not differently.
More, but...
More.
Sometimes you have to...
Take
the longer, shorter way.
How about the shorter, shorter
way?
Take the longer, shorter
way? Yes. Hadarach arukah sheikh tzara. Well, the bike is fixed, so now we're getting with success, as they say. Hey, Abba. That was wild. It's a metaphor for being greeted with adulation by the relevant parties. In this case, the relevant parties are my daughters. And the adulation is sadly lacking.
You only have two daughters.
So I would say it is a, in this case, it is a, admirational metaphor. There ought to be a crowd going wild. But sadly, what there are two children, two self-absorbed children.
Abba.
Who seem utterly uninterested in the triumphs of their pater familias.
You are annoying.
Possibly. Seems the only alternative to being ignored. I think you're going to call them the same thing.
Oh, no.